You are listening to the podcast When Life Gives You Lemons, presented by me, Emma Levy. Having worked with elite athletes for most of my career, it's always intrigued me that a significant number of high-performing individuals have encountered some form of adversity earlier in their lifetime. My fascination into this grew when I had my own brush with adversity, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer in May 2020 in the midst of the global pandemic at the age of only 36. During this period, I questioned whether it was my positive mindset or maybe something deeper, which enabled me to bounce back and to train and compete for a triathlon just 1 month following completion of all active cancer treatment. The goal of this podcast is to explore this concept further by meeting a variety of high-performing individuals who have been through adversity, but who have come back stronger. Today, I'm welcoming Mark Ormerod to the podcast. Mark is a former Royal Marine who, while serving in Afghanistan in 2007, had a devastating injury after he knelt on an improvised explosive device, which resulted in the loss of both of his legs and his right arm. Mark not only became the first triple amputee to survive on the battlefield, but he has also shown remarkable strength, physically and emotionally, in his recovery to become a multiple Invictus Games medalist, and he regularly partakes in physical challenges. Mark is now an author, motivational speaker, and has his own podcast, Beyond Limits, where he shares his thoughts on mindset and how he uses his drive, positivity, and determination to achieve his goals. Mark, thank you for coming today. This is our second attempt, isn't it? Because we had a failed attempt virtually, but we've made it.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to get chatting to you because, you know, I've listened to you speak before and I think that we do share a lot of the same values and how you come back from adversity. But can we kind of start at the beginning and just, you know, tell me a bit about your story and why you originally did join the Marines?
All right. So I was about 15 and a half.
It's very young.
Yeah, and I was coming up to the end of my compulsory education, and you have to make a choice, right? Are you going to go on to college, university, or are you going to go out, get a job, get a career? I didn't know I was doing it back then, but I was really trying to find something that I think aligned with my values and who I was. And I didn't even know what my values were when I was that young, but I just thought if I have a list and something gives me goosebumps and, you know, my gut tells me that's the thing that I want to do, then that's what I should do. That was as scientific as my approach was. Now, a bunch of my friends who I grew up with, who lived in the street next to me, they were all older than I was, and they had already left school and they had already gone into their jobs and careers or further education. And I think I had at least one friend in each branch of the military, so Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy. And I used to see them when they would come back home on leave periods, and they would always tell me these stories about these big marches that they've been on and these guns they fired. And one of them would tell me about these tanks that he gets to drive over and crush cars and stuff. And, you know, when I was going through that period of trying to make a decision, I kept coming back to that, like being a soldier, joining the military, the adventure. And, you know, it just really appealed to me. And when I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, I was a bit of a movie nerd and an action movie nerd. And so I think the combination of those two things kind of drove me towards the path of the military. Now, I didn't even know who the Royal Marines were.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, do you think the military do quite well in targeting young boys at that age who are quite into action movies and, you know, adventure? And actually at that age, it's not necessarily about your values, but it's about, oh, that looks really fun, I want to do that.
I think they did back then, but like with everything, you know, new generation comes along, they have different interests and things evolve, and then they've got to change their tactics, which is, I think, something they're struggling with a little bit now. Something I've been talking to some of my friends and people that are still serving about. So I think they're scrambling now, trying to figure out how to recruit, because it's a different generation of people. But yeah, I didn't know who the Royal Marines were, which is bizarre because I live in Plymouth. I was born in Plymouth. The Royal Marines headquarters in Plymouth. 4-2 Commander, which is one of our fighting units, is in Plymouth. I just thought that if you wanted to be a soldier and go and do all that cool stuff with guns and fitness and adventure and travel, then you just join the army, right? So my friend John, who was in the tank regiment, was on leave. He was based in Germany. But when he came home, he took me down to the career center and I spoke to the army recruiter and I took the paperwork home. Because of my age, I was still under 16 years old at this point. Your parents have to give permission and sign it so you can start the application process. And it was that point where my dad said to me, why don't you go see your uncle, he was a Royal Marine. Now, I didn't know any of this. So we got up on Saturday morning, we drove up to see him, and he sat me down for a couple of hours and talked me through his entire career. But I don't know what it was. It just appealed to me on another level, listening to what he was saying. So the following week, I went back to the career centre on my own this time, spoke to the Royal Marine recruiter, and this is in the days of VHS cassettes. So he pulled out the VHS, put it in the TV video combi, and I was just stunned. Like I just remember seeing, you know, you're talking about recruiting, this advert back then, I remember these guys assaulting a beach in a raiding craft and running off and, you know, doing what they do. They were fast jumping at helicopters. They were patrolling in the jungle up to their chest in water in the swamp. They were skiing in the Arctic with these massive packs on. And I'm just like, who the hell are these guys? You know, and I remember thinking back to the Arnie movies, the Stallone, Rambo, and I'm like, damn, this is where they got their training from, these guys. And I took the paperwork and I think I ran home from that the career centre then. And I was like, right, sign this, I want to do this. So we got it signed, sent it off. This is kind of when email wasn't a thing, it was all snail mail. But I don't know, my entire focus was just like, no, nothing else matters outside of this. I want to see if I can join this group of men, see if I've got what it takes to be part of them, and then spend the rest of my life jumping out of helicopters, assaulting beaches, skiing with packs on, and doing all this cool stuff that I saw in this video. So, like I said, I finished up, got my exam results, finished school. Because, you know, we didn't live at the speed back then that we live at now, this is like 1999, you had to just wait for a letter to turn up saying, we invite you to start. And before you can start training, you had to do what was called the Potential Royal Marines course, which is a 3-day ass kicking.
Nice.
Where you just turn up and it is just relentless for 3 days. They just want to try in a, I guess, constructive way to break you with a purpose. You know, they need to see if they think you're ready. And you need to decide, actually, is this the life for me? Because it looks great watching a video, but the reality of it is very different.
Yeah.
So that letter came. I went there, passed the 3 days, fortunately. Then they give you a training program and a kit list, and then say, just wait for the next letter. So I went home, and I gradually worked my way through this physical training program. You know, it's just runs, press-ups, pull-ups, and you progress to boots, maybe a bit of weight, and then you got to go around and buy your boot polish and your starch and all your stuff for ironing your kit and, you know, just get yourself ready. And then I don't remember exactly how long it was. It felt like forever. But then eventually, you know, the postman came, put that letter through the door, and then they invited me February 2001 to see if I had what it took to become a Royal Marines commando.
How old were you at that point?
17.
Still very young.
Yeah, I started training at 17.
Yeah. And then you go off training in the UK. And then when was your first tour? How long after that?
So Royal Marines training is 32 weeks. When you factor in Easter, Christmas, summer leave, if you do it all in one go without any injuries, without failing anything, it's basically a year. So I started in February 2001, finished in October 2001, made it through in one hit, 4 weeks after 9/11 happened. So I settled into unit life. I did the Norway thing, went out to the Arctic, learned to fight and survive in the Arctic.
Cool.
Did a bit of boxing, some exercises around the UK, bits and pieces. And then 2003, Iraq became the focus. I had turned 19 by this point. And then March 2003, I deployed for a tour of duty out to Iraq.
And how was that? Do you remember being scared at all before your first deployment, or were you just more excited?
I was excited, and I don't say that in a macho way. I think it's just because I was young and stupid, and I didn't know what the reality was. I grew up watching action movies. I thought I'd be running around with a bayonet in my teeth, getting shot, but just brushing it off, you know, going around taking out bad guys. That's not the reality of it. You know, it is actually, from my experience in certain scenarios, terrifying. You know, and the older you get, you see the bigger picture, you know, of humanity and why you're doing things. When you're young, you just do what you're told. You know, I signed the military. I've got to do what I'm told. I'm going to go and do it to the best of my ability.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't remember being scared at all. But that tour was, for me, uneventful. You know, I didn't fire a single round at an enemy. You know, I did a few cool things, but nothing that I would core worry. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it wasn't what I expected it to be.
So were you disappointed?
Bizarrely, yeah. When I came home, I wasn't disappointed in my tan. I got a great suntan after 3.5 months in the desert. But I came home and I just remember in those moments when you're on your own, you're back home and it's a bit quieter, kind of reflecting, thinking, well, is that it? Was that war? And also, you know, I've been to war this early in my career within the first 5 years. Some people can go 20 years into a career without going to experience that. And so you just start thinking, well, what now? Is this the way it's going to be for the next 20 years? Do I go out to these places, you know, have these experiences, come back? I didn't really know. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I came back a little bit disappointed. That's not the right word.
Deflated, maybe?
Yeah, it was disillusioned a little bit. But, you know, it is what it is. I just settled back into unit life and waited for the next call up, for the next thing, whatever that was going to be. I had no clue what it was going to be. You know, I just started to carry on my career and see where it was going to take me.
Yeah. And then that kind of takes you to 2007, when you're back in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then Christmas Eve, your life changes forever.
Yes.
Will you tell us about that day?
Afghanistan was very different to Iraq. It was what I think most people would envision like a war to be. You know, it was any hour of any day, at any moment's notice, you're running around in a firefight, either offensively or defensively. You know, I had firefights in my underwear at 3 o'clock in the morning just because I would get crashed out my bed to run down to defend our positions. And you are constantly in like a heightened state of readiness and alert. And every time you left the base, you leave like an opening in a wall and you're like a sniper's dream. Do you know what I mean? So you never know. Like every time you're like, right, it's my turn next, my turn next, my turn. Go, 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 go. Wow. And you're constantly living in a heightened state of adrenaline and anxiety, I guess.
And were you still excited at this point? Or at this point, was there a bit more fear?
No, I never felt fear when I deployed. And that's because I knew who was stood to my left and my right. I knew these men that I would deploy with were so highly trained and so dedicated that no matter what happened, they got my back. And that makes terrifying scenarios a lot less terrifying. Do you know what I mean? Because you know that in your heart and soul that they've been through what you've been through. You know what their values are. You know what they're about. And you know that they're going to do whatever it takes to look after you, just as I would do whatever it took to look after them. Mm. And that kind of alleviates the fear, you know? I had matured a little bit by this point. I think I was 24 when I went to Afghanistan. So I'd matured a little bit, not much. But yeah, it was very, very different. And it was what I thought war was. And the first 2 months were good. They were great. You know, we had missions and objectives. We went out and we fulfilled them to the highest standard. We were winning. We were taking a fight to the enemy. We were helping the civilians and the locals that we were there to help. And things were going great. And then on Christmas Eve morning, we were called up to the headquarters compound of the base that we were working out of. We were given the brief on our next foot patrol. And then we did what we had done 1,000 times before, went back to our living quarters, prepared all of our kit and equipment, went back up to the HQ compound, formed up by the rear entrance of the camp, and we got ready to leave. Now, the idea of this patrol, what we were told was, so we call like groups of men sections, and there's 8 men in each section. We were going to leave the rear entrance of camp in 2 sections. One was going to go north, one was going to go south. We didn't really have an objective. It was just patrol the perimeter, do the kind of things you usually do, like suspicious activity, report it back, build a picture of what's going on, what the mood's like, and any, you know, anything that needs to be reported, then you report it. There's nothing really bigger or more meaningful than that. And then when we'd finished, we were to meet at the front entrance of camp, so the opposite side now, and finish up for the day. And this was Christmas Eve. So once we were done, we were due to go back in. We had mail we could open. We had a curried goat that was being cooked for us to celebrate. So none of us had any cause for concern or any reason to worry. We hadn't been given any intelligence to say, you know, look out, this has happened there, this is going down over here. As far as we were concerned, we were going out the back door, going for a little walk and coming in the front door. Simple as that. So the time came and we were given the green light. They opened the rear door. I was second in command of the group that went north. The other guys went south, and we went out and we did what we were tasked to do. About 5 hours later, we now, both sections of men found themselves at the front entrance of camp, so the opposite side, now ready to finish up for the day. And the group that I was in were on this high piece of ground, what we called the North Fort. When we looked kind of down from this high feature, we could see a sort of semi-bird's eye view of the base that we were working out of. And then beneath that were the other group of men in quite a vulnerable position. So our job, being the section on the high ground, is to give them what we call overwatch, which is protection. They'll get into camp, get behind the perimeter wall where they're safe, they'll return the favour, and we go, it's all just what we call standard operating procedures, very basic, low-level stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're up on this high feature, and we start getting ready to give this other section of men protection. So the guy in charge, Corporal Helsby, starts giving his lads fire positions. I get my lads, and what you would normally do in this situation, if you're going to go farm on a foot patrol, is you want to get behind a building, a wall, a tree, a rock, something that's going to give you some form of cover in case you come under attack. But we didn't have those options because we were on effectively a ridgeline. And the only form of protection for the guys that I could see was this shallow bowl in the ground. So I thought, if we jump in there, get on our bellies, anyone that's looking up at us is going to have a hard time to see us, which means they'll have a hard time to engage us. You know, so I jumped in and they followed. They all started taking their fire positions. When they were happy, they gave me the thumbs up. There's a couple of checks that I have to do to make sure that we're as defensive as we possibly can be. And then when they were happy and I was happy, I started walking over towards the position that I'd selected for myself. And as I went to get on my stomach, I put my right knee on the ground. And that was the moment that I knelt on and detonated an improvised explosive device.
And you remember every moment of what happened next, don't you?
I do, yeah. It was chaotic. It was terrifying. It was overwhelming. You know, initially I thought we had come under attack. I thought someone had fired a mortar or an RPG on our position that had exploded close by, because the terrain we were working in was very sandy and dusty. So when I knelt on this thing and it exploded, this huge dust cloud was created, so I couldn't see anything. And I thought we were under attack, and I knew that where I was positioned, about 600 metres behind me on the low ground, was like a small block of trees. Everything else around that area was just flat mud fields. So in my mind, after this thing had exploded and I thought we were getting attacked, I remember saying to myself, turn around, Mark. ID the enemy and start shooting. If you start shooting, all the rest of the lads will start shooting, and then we can like make some sort of tactical withdrawal, get out, get somewhere safe, neutralise the threat, do what we got to do and get everyone back safely. Now, I couldn't see anything because of this dust cloud, but after about 4 or 5 times in my mind of saying, turn around, Mark, ID the enemy, I kind of just knew that my body wasn't doing what my brain was telling it to. So I thought, okay, I'll just wait. And you've got to bear in mind, you know, my adrenaline is spiked right now. Everything's going 1,000 miles an hour. I'm trying to calmly and logically figure out what's going on and then deal with it. But I didn't really know what was going on. So it was like, I was confused. And anyway, I knew my body wasn't doing what my brain was telling it to do. So I thought, okay, I'll wait. I'll wait till this dust cloud settles. I'll have a look around, see what's going on, make some more sense of it, and then start making some other decisions. So we got about chest height, and I looked around, and I couldn't see anybody. I think they'd all been blasted out of the area. So I carried on waiting. The dust cloud got about 6 inches from the floor, hit the ground, and disappeared. Now, as it disappeared, I looked down to where my legs should have been, and they'd both been like completely ripped off. From the knees down. You know, one side was completely destroyed, and then the other side, I had a tibia and a fibula still. My foot had been blown off, but it was the strangest thing, and I've got photographs of it. Like, there was no flesh, no muscle, no tissue on the tibia or fibula. It was almost like You know, you ever seen a really well-cooked rib and you can just clean pull the bone out? It was like that. There was no meat. It just, the heat, I guess, had just incinerated everything. And it, you could see like my kneecap and it looked like you could just snap it off like a chicken leg. And I remember just looking at this and I wasn't in any pain. And I think it's quite incredible the way your body deals with these things, because I don't know. I just, there was no pain. I wasn't panicking. I think I really struggled to process what I was looking at, and my brain struggled to understand it. And it just felt very surreal, like I was dreaming.
You kind of detach yourself from it, don't you?
I guess you do, yeah. And then probably, I probably only looked for like 2, maybe 3 seconds. And then just thought, oh, okay, I'm going to ignore it. And it was just a weird thing to think, right? But I remembered the rest of the section. So I just looked away over my right shoulder to see if I could see any of the rest of the section. And I saw Sean, the guy in charge. And we went through training together back in 2001. I'd known him a long time. And his face was completely like grey. And his eyes were huge. He was clearly in shock at what he was looking at. So in my mind, I was like trying to process the leg thing. Then I'm like, why does he look like that? And it all just felt like this massive dream. And so I went to look back to my legs to kind of make sense of what everything that was going on. And when I got to about the 3 o'clock position, I saw my arm lying in the sand. Now, it was still attached to my body, but from my bicep to my wrist, the entire thing was torn open. The upper and the lower bone in my arm was completely shattered, so it wasn't salvageable. My hand was in pretty good order, and I don't know why I did this, but I picked it up, kind of held it in front of my face, moved it around a little, dropped it in the sand, and then just let out this massive scream as the reality and the severity of the situation hit me. I knew then that we weren't under attack. I knew that I was the guy that had detonated an improvised explosive device. And I knew from obviously training what the next part of the process was,
yeah,
if it went well.
I find it remarkable how much you've remembered. Because again, from speaking to people that have been through trauma, a lot of people will fully forget the details. And you seem to really kind of remember a lot of the detail. Do you think that it is kind of like true memory, or do you think over the years you've pieced it back together by talking about it so much, and by talking about it has helped you kind of reform those memories?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of everything in there. You know, it's in the moment, you are trying to process so much stuff. It's like drinking from a fire hose. Do you know what I mean? And I'm sure that skews some things that happen and you forget some things and whatever it is. But I think there's a combination of being conscious through it all, telling the story so many times. You know, I wrote a book in 2009, which involved me speaking to a bunch of the other guys that were involved, so getting their perspective of what they saw and what happened, which was...
And was great. That the same as your perspectives? Your perspective?
Not always, but it never will be. You know, you could have 10 people in a room and something could happen and everyone will see it differently.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But by piecing it all together and speaking to these guys and girls over the years, you build a bigger picture of it. But yeah, I mean, I feel fortunate in that I do remember it, because a lot of people that I went through rehab with that were knocked unconscious from the blast don't remember it. And that's that, you know, years later they have the flashback. It's all stored somewhere, right, subconsciously. Yeah. And they'll have flashbacks and it will affect them. And I think I'm quite lucky that I've never.
So you don't struggle
that.
With any of that PTSD, flashbacks, none of that?
Nope.
Yeah.
No, I'm very lucky.
And then there was this amazing team effort, wasn't there, to get you out of that crater, because you were, what, 10 foot deep in a crater?
12 feet.
12 feet.
This is the thing, right? We drill these things tons of times, and 9 times out of 10 we'll cock it up. But when you have to do it, when someone's life's on the line, it's insane how everything just comes together. You know what I mean? And if you could write on a piece of paper, what's the worst possible scenario to evacuate a casualty from, this was probably it, because we're on high ground, the terrain's terrible, I'm in a 12 foot by 15 foot crater. There were, after I read the report, there were 6 or 7 other IEDs around me.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And then there's the very real possibility of a follow-up attack from the enemy with AK-47s and stuff. Do you know what I mean? It was like the worst case you could ever think of. But every single one of those lads in that section did everything they had to do to the highest level of, of professionalism. Like one guy was straight on the comms calling in a medic and an evacuation. One guy was coordinating all around defence in case there was a follow-up attack. I think the guy closest to me was 19 years old. And the job of him being closest to me is to take a bayonet or something to prod the ground with to feel for other devices and then mark left and right so when the medic gets to me, he can run straight into me. Because we're also trained in that situation not to go to run in to help the casualty because you risk hurting or killing yourself or further hurting and killing the casualty by setting off other devices. Now, I don't know how, as a human being, you can override every emotion you have to help your friend when they need you like that to be so professional. I don't know if I could have done it. And to see your friend lying there, you know what I mean? Bleeding out in a huge house surrounded by IEDs. I don't know how they did it. It's just a testament to how good they were at their job and how strong they were as human beings. But they did everything perfectly. The medic got to me. He had to scoop up like my foot and my hand and just throw it on my stomach and get me out of that crater, put me in a vehicle. The vehicle then drove back into the camp through the front gate that we were supposed to walk through to the helicopter landing site. And the last thing I can remember is this Chinook helicopter landing, like the sandstorm that's created from the propeller blades and then the heat of the exhaust beating down on me in the back of this vehicle. And then I blacked out. This is the last thing I can remember.
Yeah, and they thought you were dead, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Yeah, when they put me on to the helicopter, there were two casualties. There was me and there was another guy called Milky who had shrapnel in his back and in his tricep. Now, the way they prioritise casualties in a wartime situation like this is if you've got a guy that's dead and a guy that's dying, you have to leave the dead guy and put all your attention on the guy that's dying because you don't want two dead guys. So they felt me for a pulse. I didn't have one. They tried putting intravenous lines into me to give me fluids, but my veins had all collapsed because of the blood loss. And then when they put an oxygen mask on me, they said it should have steamed up to show that I was breathing, but it didn't. So they classed me as dead and put me in a corner and put all their attention on Milky. When one of the medics went past me to get some equipment to go back and work on Milky, he said that my eyes started to flutter, which meant my heart was beating. So he alerted some of the other medics. I don't remember any of this. I was completely out of it from this whole thing. But he alerted some of the other medics. They came to start working on me. And 3 days before I was injured, the people in charge of the military medical world had given the go-ahead for this new technique to be used where if you can't put fluids into somebody's veins, you can drill into their tibia and fibula, and that's an effective way to do the same job. Problem being, you know, I didn't have any tibias or fibias that would have worked on. So, and you've got to bear in mind, right, we're in a Chinook helicopter. It's full of sand and dust. I, at that time, was like the worst casualty they'd ever seen. I was just like a slab of meat that had been attacked by dogs, like just lying there. They had no clue what to do with me. There was no proven series of events to bring me back. They had to just make it up on the spot. And also, this Chinook is, it's not flying steady because they fly a certain way in case rockets and stuff come from the ground to try and take them out.
Yeah.
So they're going left to right. You know, it's not a stable or a clinical environment. And they just made some very quick decisions and said that if we'll try and drill into his hip bone, that's a big bone, we'll get fluids in there, see if that works. First time it failed because they said they didn't pull my skin tight enough.
Mm-hmm.
Second time, they pulled it tighter, put the line in, one in the front, one in the back. They had to drill in with like a medical drill. And the second time, the line bit. And they said within about 3 minutes, I was awake and responsive and answering the questions that they were asking me.
Wow. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we were talking before about you do motivational speaking and you talk about teamwork. Mm. And so much of that rescue sounds just like, you know, the perfect team and everything just worked so well together. What do you think makes the perfect team?
I think you have to share similar values and standards. You have to have people that complement other members of the team's weaknesses. It depends what kind of scenario you're in. Like for us, in that scenario on the ground, you get put through so much adversity and intense training that you bond in a way. You understand each other on a different level. You can almost, you know, if I'm with a guy and we're maybe, if you're kicking a door in and storming a room, I'll know from the way his body moves that we're, what he's going to do next. You know what I mean? So you have to really be intimately connected in some scenarios, particularly in that kind of scenario, to the other members of your team, almost like you know what they're going to say before they say it, that kind of thing. That's not always relevant in, like, you know, if you're organising a team in Tesco's, you don't have to go to that kind of level to have an effective team. But you need to just understand each other on a different level.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's what makes an effective team, I think. And be willing to do whatever it takes. There's no room for selfishness, I don't think. Mm. One of our, you know, we've got values and standards, and one of them is unselfishness.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be there for your team, for your what we call oppo, which is your mate, and then yourself, you're the last one that you think of.
Yeah, because they all risked their life, really, to save you, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. They did, yeah. It was, you know, it's insane. It was obviously difficult for me being the one that was injured, but I often think, you know, if I wasn't and I was in that team, would I have been able to perform to the level that they performed at? You know, would my emotions and my human instincts have taken over, or would I have been able to just push that to the side that they did and be completely professional the whole time?
Yeah.
And you do. And if they weren't, if anybody, you know, dropped the ball, if anybody froze, if anyone got emotional, I'd be dead.
When you recount the story 17 years on, how does it make you feel?
I don't know. I'm very matter of fact with it. When I do talk about it, I have a immense sense of gratitude for them, for everybody. Do you know what I mean? Because there are so many, I could go into so many details about everything that happened from the minute I stood on that thing all the way through to the end of my rehab. And people just went above and beyond in every part of that chain, you know? And I still meet people now. They're like, oh yeah, I was the guy on the radio that called in the helicopter and we did this, and you know, this was happening, that was happening. It was just lucky that this person was here at that time to do it. And there's like thousands of these little things that if one thing went differently, I could be dead.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And you can't help but feel grateful.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you went back to the UK and you had your surgeries, I imagine, and then it's time to rehab. And I don't know if you know, but I'm a physiotherapist. Mm. So I've worked in amputee rehab before, and I know how hard it is to teach yourself how to walk when you've got, you know, one leg, but you were missing two legs and an arm.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about those challenges and how you got back to where you are today, really?
I'm not going to lie. It was brutal. You know, I was the first triple amputee from the conflict. I think the first one since the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what to do with me.
Yeah.
They had dealt with amputees before. I think the most severe was a bilateral double above knee. The guy who had two arms, and it's a whole different world when you've lost your arm, especially your dominant one, and no one knew what to do. So it was like wading through treacle, and it was irritating and it was frustrating because I just wanted to make progress as fast as I could. And I'm not exaggerating, every day something that I thought would be simple was just a massive headache, and no one knew what to do, and we had to test and adjust and figure stuff out as we were going. And I got to a point quite early on where I was like, I need a mentor. I need someone who's been through this, come out the other side, and is doing the things that in my mind I can see myself doing, but we're all struggling to figure out.
Hmm.
So,
but a doctor had told you quite early on, hadn't they, that you were never going to walk again?
Yeah.
But you heard that and thought, that's not true.
Not initially. Initially, and this is the serious side of the conversation, initially that made me want to take my own life. Because I was 24, and this guy had been amputating people for over 33 years, and this is the beginning of 2008, and he said, you've got no chance, because in my experience, which was 33 years, he had never met anybody missing one leg above the knee that had successful prosthetics, because it was too painful, they were too difficult to use, and they took too much energy.
Yeah.
And he literally just like turned around and walked out after that. So I'm like, okay, great. So here I am. You know, last week I was 6'2". I was a Royal Marine. I was running around doing the job I loved. I was fit, strong, healthy. Now I'm 24. I think at the time I was under 9 stone in weight because of the limb loss and the infections I was fighting off. I had no clue what the future held, but this expert told me it was going to be shit.
Yeah, which is not what you want to hit.
No, but then within about 5 days, I think it was, I had a visit from a guy who'd lost both his legs above the knee in the army in 2005, and that motivated me.
Okay.
And then literally the hour after he left, I got a laptop brought in my hospital room, got hooked up to Wi-Fi and started looking for a triple amputee who was out there just living and doing, you know, what I wanted to do. And, you know, the internet had rolled around at this point. And I found a guy very quickly out in America who was hit by a train in 2002, lost both legs above the knee, right arm above the elbow. And he was doing phenomenal stuff, stuff that all my team were telling me wasn't possible. Because it's very, very different to be a below-the-knee amputee to an above-the-knee. Because you don't have any knees, right? I mean, you know this.
Yeah. And we get a lot of balance from our knees, a lot of, you know, and awareness.
And, you know, things like walking up and down stairs. Yeah. And just a million things that having knees, it makes it so much easier. And so all my team were saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't walk downstairs without holding on, you can't walk down ramps without sticks, you can't do any of this stuff. But this guy was doing it all. So I'm like, well, if he can do it, so can I. I just need to follow his processes, physical, mental, and I'll get similar results. So I emailed him, and I didn't expect a reply back. You know, this world was very, very new to me. And, you know, he looked extremely busy. He was traveling around as a speaker. He was an athlete doing triathlons and surfing and all this cool stuff.
What's his name?
His name's Cameron Clapp. But he did get back to me, and he introduced me to his team, and we started emailing back and forth. Now, the short version of this is, I asked for permission from the military to go and meet these people and train with them. I told him, I said, look, this is a triple amputee. Look what he's doing. He's doing this, that. Look what his team have done. This is what they've said. They've been doing that. At that point, they've been rehabbing for 6 years. So lots of success, lots of failures, lots of learnings. I got told, no, you can't go.
Ooh.
After about 2 weeks of not being able to sleep, of, you know, just trying to figure out, do I go, don't I go, why can't I go, I need to go, this is going to change my life, like waking up, having conversations with my wife at 2-3 in the morning. In the end, I thought, stuff it,
yeah,
I'm going to go. And that's not an easy decision because, you know, it sounds a bit robotic, but you're a soldier and you've got to do what you're told to do. And I didn't want to face any disciplinary action, but I thought, well, in 10 years, none of these people are going to be in my life. And if I don't go, I won't know. So
that's a brave decision.
Yeah. And I just, you know, 9th of June 2009, I booked a plane to fly to Oklahoma. I arranged it with all them. Didn't tell the MOD that I was going. And the American guys that were going to train me said, we're absolutely happy to do this. You can spend 3 weeks over here, but you have to come on your own. And you can't bring your wheelchair because we're going to aim everything towards you living life without a wheelchair. Now, at that point, I couldn't go half a day without a wheelchair because it was exhausting. It was painful. It did take a lot of energy. And I thought about backing out. But I slept on it. You know, the date was getting closer. I think it was like the 7th of June at this point. And I was like, I'm just going to go. I know it'll be hard. I'm going to struggle through it. If they can't give me what I need, at least I'll know, and I'll come home and just muddle my way through the rest of it. So, you know, 9th of June 2009, I got on a plane, flew out to America, didn't tell anybody except my wife, and that trip changed my life. You know, I haven't used a wheelchair since the 9th of June 2009. It was unbelievably hard.
Yeah.
I threw a lot of temper tantrums. I was always in pain because my body was still adjusting to prosthetics. I had no wheelchair to rest in. I had no support around me. And it was very much tough love. You know, I remember at the airport with a suitcase getting told to go down the escalator instead of the lift, and I fell.
Oh, my God.
And right, and all these people are coming behind me on the moving staircase, and I'm grabbing the handrail to try and stand up, but the handrail moves as well. And I just kept on falling over, tripping over my suitcase. And the guys that were with me were like, Mike, get up, hurry up. You're holding the line up. And I'm losing my temper. And, you know, I just covered in bruises and cuts and sores and everything like that. But I knew that it was short-term pain for long-term gain, and that at the end of it, I was going to be better and I could advance my life and take things forward, but it was going to suck for 3 weeks. Yeah. And it did suck for 3 weeks.
But 3 weeks is a very short period of time.
Oh, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. It's a long period
didn't
of time.
Feel it. So that tough love approach, which is so different to the approach I imagine you're having here, do you think we should be giving people more of that in our healthcare systems over here?
I mean,
our rehab systems probably more.
To a degree, it's a very individual thing. I was in the military system, so that, you know, the men and women were kind of used to a bit of tough love. But back then, I don't say any of this disrespectfully, but back then, the rehab over here, we weren't even allowed outside for the fear of wind blowing you over and you falling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and when I came back after having, you know, been driving, been shopping, carrying my own bags, going to out to eat, doing all these things. And eventually I got the team that I work with to come over to the UK. And they work with a team here in the UK, spent about 3 or 4 days with a bunch of patients, teaching them some of the stuff that they taught me. And it was a bit of a weird period. I wasn't particularly popular with the military back then because of what I'd done. But I saw the value in it and I saw how many people it could help. And I brought them over, and I don't know whether they'll ever admit it or not, but they changed their entire rehabilitation system because of that visit.
Really?
Yeah, and they did start doing a bit more of the tough love approach. They learned a lot. Because the thing is, with these prosthetics, there are a lot of people losing both their legs above the knee. They give you the best prosthetics in the world.
Yeah.
But prior to going to America, they weren't optimized for me. And I always say it was like having a Ferrari with square wheels.
Mm.
And when I went to America, they gave me round wheels so I can get the most out of it.
Yeah.
And then so they started looking into this change and stuff, veering away from the textbook setup of this must be done this way, blah, 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 blah. And they started going outside those parameters. And then what I saw was men and women doing in 6 months what was taking me 18.
Mm.
And they were leaving rehab being maybe 3/4 as a prosthetic user and 1/4 as a wheelchair user.
Yeah.
Rather than before, it was like the other way around.
Yeah.
And so I knew it had done good.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But you do, as a triple amputee, still have to endure difficulties, I imagine. Things like, I mean, do you get things like phantom limb pain, pain from your prostheses, any of that normal amputee difficulties?
One of the things they taught me in America was how to get rid of the phantom limb pain. And again, this is one of the reasons I wasn't that popular. I went through a process called desensitization.
Yeah.
So I started on a bed where I'd just stand up with no prosthetics and put weight through my femurs,
mm-hmm,
for as long as I could hold it. Then I would graduate down to a pillow on the ground, then like a carpet or a rug, then a carpet, then a tiled floor or a wooden floor. I did that before going to America. That's what they told me I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, cured my phantom limb pain and sensation. I think it retrained my brain to tell it where my limbs ended.
Mm.
I stopped taking medication 14 months into my recovery. Like, I'm not a doctor, but I cold turkey.
Yeah.
Stopped taking them one night. Just decided I wasn't going to take them to America. Ditched it. Woke up the next day with no pain. I'm like, okay, cool. This is nice. It's one less thing to do. And then, you know, by being in the prosthetics when I was out there every day without a wheelchair, it just kind of toughened up my residual limbs and stop the pain and the sensation,
mm,
you know. And of course, from time to time, I'll get sores. You know, like when I took my family to Disneyland in 2017, that's a lot of walking. It's like running, like for an able-bodied person doing a marathon, I think. And I'd have to treat it a bit like that. I'd get up in the morning and I'd have to be, you know, I don't eat breakfast. I don't eat any day until like lunchtime. But in that scenario, because I know I'd be doing a lot of walking, I would have like 200 grams of oats and carb up, ready for a day of intense walking, and live like an athlete almost. Which sounds a bit nutty and obsessive, but it's just the reality of my life now. If I've got something what I know is going to be extremely, it's going to take a lot of energy, then I have to incorporate that into my diet to be able to get through the day.
Yeah.
So it's either that or just get in a wheelchair, which I don't want to do.
Yeah. And how much of your success over the years do you attribute to mindset?
I would say, I mean, there's a lot to consider. It's a split between mindset, the people that are around me, and the goals that I set.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to just create a different kind of mindset, you know, in whatever field you're in, if you want to succeed. The minute I saw the guy in the hospital kind of visit me, the minute I saw Cameron, my mindset changed, because I was told by a professional, you're never going to walk again. But I saw with my own eyes two people doing it. And then I don't think, my belief is with all human beings, if you want to replicate excellence in somebody, then you just got to find out their physical and mental processes and replicate them as closely as you can. And then you're going to get very similar results, right? So that's why spending 3 weeks so close with these guys was important, because I got to dig into their mindsets and figure out the way they thought and how they approached these challenges. And then I kind of incorporated that into my own life.
Yeah. So you surrounded yourself with those positive people.
Yes.
Which obviously helped as well. Yeah. Did you ever go through the period of asking, why me?
In the beginning I did, yeah. Especially that first 6 weeks in hospital, when you've got nothing to do but, you know, get fed through a tube and watch DVDs lying in a hospital bed.
So what advice would you give to someone who's in that phase, you know, a newly injured amputee maybe, who's questioning why me and who can't see the future or is scared for the future? What advice would you give that person?
Why not me? Do you know what I mean? Why not me? Do you know what I mean? There's obviously a reason why this happened. Well, not obviously, but I believe there is a reason why this happened. I believe part of that reason is that I had what it took to get through it. Although if you'd asked me that in the first 6 weeks, I would have just kicked you out of my hospital room and just said, go away. But now, you know, getting older and reflecting, you know, it's a journey, right? And I was forced completely out of my comfort zone and forced to grow into the person that I needed to become to live my life the way that I live my life now. And it's not easy, because I see people in similar situations to me all the time, and I'm not judging, but they'll go the opposite way. And they'll just give up, and they'll drink and take drugs and not be interested. You know, I don't know why my mindset was different. I just think maybe the way I grew up, the people that I was around when I grew up, the Royal Marines training, it showed me that your physical ability is only, I'd say, 40%. Of your success in most things. Most of it is in your mind. And I actually remember one of my instructors telling me, because I was never the fittest or the fastest or the strongest, I would always be lagging at the back when we do runs and stuff. And he said to me, when that little voice creeps into your mind, where you're, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes.
When you're saying, shit, fuck, this is crap, bollocks, fuck it. That, when that voice creeps in, physically, and it had been proven, you're only like 40% of the way to your body failing. And when he said that to me, I thought about it, I picked out scenarios previously in training where I knew that to be true, where I'd been so drained and tired, or I thought I was, and wanted to quit, but then carried on like for another 4 or 5 hours. And I'm like, damn, maybe he's right. And then I started getting excited for that voice coming. So I'm like, oh, cool, I'm only 40% away. Let's keep going. And then when you put yourself through stuff like that, you understand what humans are capable of.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so you were training yourself to be resilient.
I didn't know that at the time.
You didn't
I was just
know
training
that.
Myself to get a green beret.
Yeah.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? But yeah, and you train yourself to be resilient. And it's a powerful, powerful thing.
Yeah. If you went back in time, Mark, would you change what happened?
Nah.
No.
No. I've got a really cool life now. Loads of cool experiences. You know, I turned 40 last year and I feel like my life's only just begun. And there's loads more stuff that I want to do, loads more stuff that I'm going to do. None of us can predict, you know, what our lives would be like now had they taken a different turn. I had a plan. If that plan had been successful, I probably wouldn't be a father of three now. Probably wouldn't be married now, because the life that I would have chosen would have took me in a direction. Well, that stuff's very difficult to have. So who knows? But, you know, this was the path that I was pushed onto. It's been a lot of fun. I've had a lot of cool experiences. And, you know, hopefully along the way, I helped a few people.
Yeah. So what's next? Where can people find you?
I'm all over social media. I am on a big push now from 40 to 50. I get very uncomfortable when I talk about this, because it seems very shallow. but I'm on a big push now, business-wise, financially, like monetarily. I've spent the last 16 years like fundraising, pushing myself physically, you know, creating my life. And I feel like I've ticked most of the boxes that I want to tick when it comes to accomplishment, but I've never ticked any boxes to do with business and money. And the reason I want to do it is the same reason I've done everything else leading up to this point, is because in my mind, I think, if as a man with one hand, an internet connection, a smartphone, if I can create businesses, grow those businesses, make vast amounts of money through those businesses, then no one else can say that they can't do it. Do you know what I mean? That's my motivation for it.
Yeah.
I'll probably give most of it away because I'm not really that bothered about, as long as I've got enough to, you know, hit the basics and have a little bit of fun, I'll probably just give most of it away. But I've had this urge for the last couple of years now to prove it to myself that I can do it. Yeah. So that's what we're focused on.
That's really exciting. Look forward to seeing what happens. Thank you, Mark. Awesome. Thank you so much. We're going to have to tie it up. But, you know, thanks for talking to us, because it's remarkable stories like yours who made me want to start this podcast in the first place. Mm-hmm. And to hear from individuals who've been through like life, you know, changing catastrophic injuries, but then come out stronger and better versions of themselves. Mm-hmm. I just think if people listening, it can inspire them so much. So thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And yeah, we look forward to watching the journey.